Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum. You like when I say Baum sometimes?
I do. I know that's how you say it, but well, you put an inflection on it that is silly.
It's Michael Rosenbaum. How's that?
Michael Rosenbaum?
Well, that's the real expression of it.
Well,
that's
it sounds like you're doing a soundtrack for a porn.
Baum. 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 Great. Now, I guarantee Jason just put porn music on there. Thanks, Jason. I know you did that. You're smiling because you did it. Thanks for being here on another glorious Tuesday or whenever you're listening to your podcast. And thank you for making this podcast.
Your choice.
Your choice. I mean, there's so many podcasts, but you know, we've been around. We're not one of those podcasts that just jumped on the bandwagon. We've been doing this when we had no listeners, and now we have a loyal fan base and my patrons who really support me and support the podcast. They give back to the podcast to make this podcast possible. That's patron, patreon.com/insideofyou. And join Patreon today. Become a member. There's so many perks. Look at it. You'll have a blast. It's a great family. And also the Inside of You online store. You can get cool stuff like this sweet Inside of You tumbler, coffee tumbler, which I use. I have different colors. There's yellow, there's silver, there's all sorts of more colors.
I was using the one today with a little
straw.
No, a little divot.
The divots. Divot.
Yeah, divots.
Yeah,
divots.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I love that one. The yellow, the golf one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's a great one. Tons of stuff. Smallville ship keys that also I sign. Funko, Lex Luthor, and Pops, Flash, Lexmas scripts, and tons of Inside of You stuff. So get on there in the Inside of You online store and get yourself some nice stuff. And by the way, all this stuff is on my Instagram, at the Michael Rosenbaum. You just go to my link tree, shake the link tree, and it will show you the cons I'm going to, that me and Welling are going to and doing Smallville Nights, and everything is on there. My Rosie's Puppy Fresh Breath, dog breath additive. You just add it a little to water, tasteless, odorless. It's on there. Please check it out. It's on Amazon, and it really works. I love it. I use it on my dogs, and so much more on the link tree on my Instagram. Kamal Nanjiani.
Mm-hmm.
This is his second time on, and this was recorded actually during the
strike. Yeah.
Kamal is just such a great guy and super talented and always so busy. People always want to work with this guy. And when you know him like I do, you know, we're not tight, but we're friends. He came over when I had a party, and I love him. I love his wife, Emily. I think they're the sweetest souls out there, and he deserves all the success. He worked hard for it. And so we get into a lot of his life, and I thought it was a really good episode. Also, if you want to go to Sunspin, my band, sunspin.com, support the band. We're trying to make a new album. We do stage-its, which are live performances, virtual. We might do one on December 10th. Or not December 10th, February 10th, which is a Saturday at 5 p.m. So I think we're going to lock that in. And you can go to sunspin.com for merch, which I have. There's so much cool merch there. These wicked hats and tumblers and other stuff too. So check out sunspin.com. And without further ado, let's get into my inside of my buddy, Kamal Nanjiani.
It's my point of view. You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum.
Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum was not recorded in front of a live studio audience.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen. back then, what you had to do to get into premises was so easy. Like in Weird Science, they're just like, we should have a girlfriend. Let's make a girl on your computer. And then they just make it. And that's it. That's the whole premise. That's the whole setup. There's no like breaking into a lab. There's no lightning strike or magical amulet.
Stories were simpler in the 80s.
I mean, just getting into it was like, we know you just want to get to it. So let's just do it. It was also a different thing was like, now every character has to have some like backstory about why they are the way they are.
And it has to be allegorical.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly. Gosh. Everything has to be thematic. And it's also like, this bad guy's not really a bad guy. He had a rough childhood. Like, sometimes I don't care. I just want someone to be really fucking evil, and that's it.
Do you, though? Do you not want to have some, like, subtext, some, like, backstory on the evil guy so you, like, at least go, okay? Because usually they're just bad.
And I'm not like, always. I don't always want that. I do want it sometimes.
Right.
But sometimes, like, you know, it's sort of this thing that became, like, you know, these horror icons that we grew up with, like, all the big, you know, Jason and all those guys who we love. And then at
right
some
next
point,
to you.
Yeah, Jason's next to me, Freddy's up there. You know, it sort of became at some point like, well, how did they get this way? What happened to them? I don't really care.
Well, I guess it's a slasher flick, but think about it. What if Michael Myers, was there a backstory to Michael Myers? Really? Yeah.
I mean, sort of.
He was in an insane asylum.
He's just the shape. He's just evil. So I actually like that backstory because they're like, no, Halloween, the Rob Zombie ones had backstory on him. He had a fucked up childhood. Whereas in the original one, you know, Donald Pleasance is just like, this thing is evil. And that's it. And I thought that was cool. It gives me more, you know, have my mind swim around in. Whereas, you know, I think Rob Zombie is a great filmmaker.
He does what he does.
I just sometimes feel like I don't need backstory on all the,
I agree.
Brian Posehn, I think, had a really funny bit about like Darth Vader's backstory. It's like, I just want to eat the ice cream. I don't want to know like what, you know, we churned the butter or whatever. I think there's a balance because I think with some things, having a bad guy who's a bad guy is good. But then sometimes I think, this happens with like notes, you know, we get notes from studios and stuff and it'll always be like, well, what's the bad guy's deal? And then you spend all this time making the bad guy's fucking deal. And then suddenly you're like, focusing on something that was never really part of your story. Doesn't really care about
it. It's taking away from moving the action forward.
Yeah.
I understand.
Sometimes you just need an obstacle. You just need an antagonist, you know?
Like, do you love horror movies?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Emily and I are both hardcore, old school, since I was a little kid, horror movie fans. And we watch everything, great stuff, bad stuff.
What's good?
Did you see Talk to Me? That just came out.
I liked it.
Yeah.
Okay.
I thought Talk to Me was really good.
It was good?
Yeah, it was totally good. I liked the new Evil Dead, too.
Evil Dead Rising?
Yeah.
I had fun with it.
Yeah, I had fun with it.
Those were rarities, though, because there aren't many good ones.
It's tough. Because I think horror has become very popular and has become like a moneymaker. And whenever that happens, it was always like a niche, you know, and now it's sort of the only thing that performs in theaters. It's superheroes and horror that really performs in theaters. So now suddenly horror is getting a little diluted when it used to really just be a real expression of the filmmaker. Like some of the stuff that Wes Craven did was like, you know, it really felt like nobody but him could have made it. And now you watch a lot of the horror movies that get big where you're like, oh, I could. The process that sort of dilutes other movies is now diluting horror movies. So I like when something like Talk to Me comes out where it's like, oh, clearly these two guys made this fucked up movie.
Yeah, and it's cool that it's hard to come up with a really cool concept, something that hasn't been done. And also when you're dealing with the 70s and 80s, you're dealing with no technology really, no cell phones, so it's creepier. People can't make the call, they can't go online, they can't do all the things. So now you're really going, why didn't he just do that?
Yeah.
Why didn't he just call them?
Dude, I used to do a lot of stand-up, I'm back to doing stand-up now again, but I used to have a bit about that where it was like, before you go to the horror movie, they have to have like, oh no, I dropped my phone in Sprite. You know, everyone has to like, I forgot to charge my phone.
I'm dying.
Yeah. Every horror movie in the first act had to be like, I don't have any bars. Like that just became.
We have to know that right away. So we, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's hard. You know, like movies like like The Hitcher and stuff much harder to do now, because it used to be you could go to the middle of the country and there's nothing around. And there's one guy chasing you. What the fuck do you do? And I think I think that sort of, you know, mystery and magical nature of like those weird parts of the country have kind of gone too with the connection and all that. But, you know, you have this poster of Bram Stoker's Dracula here.
And do you see that it's signed by Gary Oldman?
Oh, my fucking
God. I have crossed the oceans of time to find you.
What a great line. See, what's great about that movie? I had watched it when I was a kid, when it first came out. And I played the video game and I liked it, but I feel like I didn't get it. And then in
the video game,
there's a video.
There's Bram Stoker's Dracula video game.
Yeah, they thought it was going to be like this huge blockbuster thing. Instead, it's this really fucking weird, idiosyncratic movie. Right? So they had a video game for like, it was for the Genesis. And I think they had it for the Sega CD.
You play video games like crazy. You still do it.
I still do it.
Does Emily hate it?
Emily loves it. We both play video games. We both watch horror movies. We both play video games. We both love it.
Wow.
We're playing Zelda right now.
Zelda?
Yeah, it's great.
You mean back in the day Zelda?
There's a new one.
There's a new Zelda.
Yeah, it's called The Tears of the Kingdom.
How many hours do you spend a day on your video games?
It's pretty limited. Rarely more than 1 hour.
How do you really get into a game only with 1 hour?
Well, that's the thing. But on Saturday or Sunday, we'll do a longer session. So you gotta, that's the thing. Like Emily's always like, you have like a problem starting games because you know the first time you need to do like a 3 hour session to really get into it. Otherwise, you're just going to be bored.
Yeah. What are the great games right now?
I'm playing, Bridging the Horror and the thing, you know, they just remade Resident Evil 4 and Dead Space. They look like brand new games, and both those games are fucking fantastic.
Are they scary?
Dead Space is really, really scary. With Resident Evil, you know, it's more of an action game, and as like a real, I'm getting real nerdy, I love Resident Evil because it was always about you have 3 bullets, and this, you gotta like, you are completely underpowered. And then Resident Evil 4 made it an action game, and suddenly you have like a lot of bazookas and shotguns, and suddenly it's an action game, and it's not as scary, not as atmospheric. And at the time, I didn't like it because I was like, this is not my Resident Evil. Now playing it again, knowing what it is, I really loved it.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't know how you have time to do anything. Since we talked last, and it's been years. But your career has just taken off even more. It's like, it's just obvious. It's like, you know, the Obi-Wan series and Eternals and Chippendales and getting nominated and all these things. And it's weird. I look at you and you came over the house like a couple weeks ago or whatever, and you just don't feel now. I don't know if you're a bullshit artist or you're really good at playing. I'm cool. I'm fine. I'm not stressed. But I mean, even with the stress, I mean, do you stress out? Do you freak out? Are you getting the anxiety? Are you overwhelmed by now being in, you know, really up there now with all these opportunities?
That's an interesting question. I do have anxiety, and it's been an issue for many, many years. And it was a few years ago actually where I realized like, oh, this is untenable. It's too much anxiety. And it was a few things. I realized that I had associated work with stress and nerves and anxiety. And it had become like, because of stand-up, you know, right before you go do stand-up. Ooh. And that was the first work I did. You've done stand-up.
So you're nervous.
Your heart's beating. And I used to smoke, you know, back then. I would just be like, smoke 4 cigarettes and drink a Red Bull and then go on stage completely like wired and so up. And so I sort of associated that body feeling with my work. And it was really hard for Emily. And it was really hard for me. And it was really, my work suffered. And I realized it was right before Eternals, actually, where I was like, this is by far the biggest thing I've ever done, maybe the biggest thing I'll ever do. This is so important to me. But if I'm like nervous or anxious about this, I'm going to choke the fuck out of it. So I need to relax. And so I started seeing a therapist and learned the ways to like really sort of let things go. And I've realized that when I'm relaxed, I'm better at my job. I'm better at acting. Now I'm better at stand-up. I'm a better husband. All that stuff.
Wow.
So I meditate every day. And I still have anxiety and stuff, you know, but I've especially those middle of the night thoughts, you know, when you wake up and you're sort of like, what is this thing?
I had one last night.
Yeah. What was that?
I don't remember exactly what happened, but I had one of those dreams where people that I don't like were still a big part of my life and dictating what I do, and sort of like, it was just, and I don't know what that means, but it was almost like they were telling me something.
Yeah.
And I don't know, but I have some dark dreams. I should write them down because they're Clive Barker shit sometimes.
I find, at least for me, you know, the way I can like interpret my dreams, and I'm not one of those, I don't believe that they tell the future or anything like that. It's just like, to me, it's just a snapshot of your subconscious. To me, whatever my biggest clue to what my brain is trying to tell me is the emotion I associate with the dream and the emotion I associate with the people that are in the dream. So for instance, for a long time, Emily and I, you know, we've been married 16 years now. Jeez. We have a cat. She's 15. So she's been with
How
us.
How old's the cat?
15.
I mean, what's the name I meant?
Bagel.
Bagel is your cat.
Yeah.
Now, what last name do you use? Nanjiani?
We use Gordon.
Gordon.
At the vet.
Bagel Gordon.
Bagel Gordon.
Bagel Gordon.
Bagel Gordon. Yeah. But she's been with us the whole time. And I, for a long time, if I had a dream about her being in distress, something happened to her, or she's missing, or me worrying about her, that was about my relationship with Emily. It was about some, I realized that the feelings associated with that, and it always seemed to coincide with when, you know, Emily had and I had an issue we were dealing with or something. So I realized that it was about that. Since then, you know, more recently, she's an older cat. She's had some health problems. So now I had a dream last night that she wasn't doing well. And that now that really is just about her.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
And we you go to therapy every week.
Yeah, I go basically every week. Right, right.
And are you like me where you're like, I'm going to cancel. I have nothing to really talk about. And then you get in there and all of a sudden it's the floodgates open.
Yeah, I do cancel sometimes. I do. Yeah. And sometimes the floodgates open. But I had my last recent one where I was like, I think I'm doing pretty well. There's not much to talk about. And then I think even she was bored. Like, we're both just like,
I've done that. I did this once with a therapist. It was about 40 minutes and I go, all right, well, my time's up.
Yeah.
So thank you. Yeah, let's schedule something else.
Looking at the clock. Although, dude, I had another session that I sort of, you know, I started doing stand-up again and it sort of opened up some interesting old patterns for me that we can get into if you want to. But it's sort of like regarding anxiety. And so I was like, I need to have like two or three sessions with you in a row because I need to figure out what's going on. And so the last session of that, we were just talking about it and I was sort of talking about the strike and how I can't work. So I've had to do stand up. And she's like, describe yourself without using your profession or your work or what you do. And I had a panic attack. I was like, she's like, what are you if you're not like an actor, comedian, writer? I was like, I don't know.
That's weird.
Yeah.
Right. So you can't associate yourself other than who you are is what you do.
Yeah, man, you don't have that issue. I mean,
to a point, but I've been working on it for like 5 years where I kind of took a break from acting and I'm starting to get the bug back.
Yeah.
Cause my anxiety is at a much better level and I'm working on a lot of things. But I think it was always about that. I think it was always about, you know, because people think, they say, oh, what are you doing? And you're compelled to say,
dude, it's so
oh,
hard.
Well, I've done that. I'm doing that. Nothing is coming to fruition. But I got a lot of
pans.
I got a lot of things to stir.
Spinning a lot of plates.
A lot of plates spinning. But then I'm like, because I felt like they needed to know I was important, maybe, or I felt like I needed to be important. And it's,
of course.
And really, it's about, you know, when people say, what do you do now? I go, you know what? I sort of got, this is what I say now. I go, I'm just trying to have fun.
Yeah.
And when I say that,
yeah,
it means fun with everything. I'm trying to have fun with work.
Dude.
I'm trying to have fun. I want to be present and fun with you. I want to be present and fun with my friends. I want to be a present fun when I'm writing.
Yeah.
And if, you know, I'm thinking, well, what if they hire a different, you know, writer and fire me? I'm like, I can't control that. That's the future. Just have fun, do what you can, and whatever happens, happens.
Dude, that
is, I'm trying.
That's the key to everything. And I'm trying too. I mean, you bring up anxiety, and I, you know, for me, anxiety is, it's a constant, I don't want to say battle because it's not a battle, but it is a constant thing that you have to work on. Like, it's not like, and now I have no anxiety.
Yeah.
Anxiety comes back. You need to know how to understand, how to see it, understand it, and deal with it. But that shit, what you said about control is so true, because for a long time, I mean, the last few years of my career, when I had a lot more opportunities, I found myself, you know, it was after the Big Sick, and then suddenly, you know, I was getting offers and I had never gotten that. I had fought to get like one scene in a movie and suddenly I had all this stuff. And I realized that the way I was evaluating what I wanted to do and what I didn't want to do was all completely messed up. I was looking at like, okay, if I do this, this movie's going to come out in theaters. It's going to be a big hit. Then I'll get more. I was always results based on my decision making for those like 3 years or so. And then I realized, you know, I did stuff that should have been a home run, and then it wasn't. Like Eternals, you know, it was Oscar winning director, one of the craziest casts. You know, you had like legends. You had Salma Hayek. You had Angelina Jolie. You had new people who were amazing: Brian Tyree Henry, Barry Keoghan, who have both been nominated for Oscars.
So you thought it was just a slam dunk?
I was like, this is going to be a slam dunk, and it'll be great. It'll open all this stuff for me. And going into it was great for me because I was like, I need to have fun doing this movie. And so I just, and I did. And I was like, I understand this movie in my bones. I understand superheroes. I understand sci-fi. I understand like sci-fi epics. And so I had the best time doing that movie. And I realized this is what work should feel like. However, when that movie came out and the reviews weren't good, that was very, very tough for me. And I realized that too much of how I'm evaluating what I want to do is based on the result, what other people think of it.
Me too. My whole life was that. I remember going, you know, doing a movie and saying, oh, these people aren't like you said. And, you know, it's a big studio. And I remember even being so obsessive. Is that the right word? I think with each scene going, okay, this scene I was really good in. That's good. That's going to be good. This scene, I think. I was good in that.
Yeah.
I think and like evaluating every scene.
Yeah. Going, it's like, oh, that okay. Scene I wasn't quite, but I think it'll be okay. Cause the one before I was good and the one after I was good. So that'll bridge it.
Yeah. And then, you know, they'll see this and then this should be, you know, I should be projecting all this stuff that my therapist says, if you can't control it, if you can't change it, shelve it.
Yeah.
Shelve the fucker. Just, and what you're saying is enjoying the ride.
Yes.
One of my friends said he had a movie that bombed. I mean, Rosen bombed. And he said, I go, how do you feel about it? He goes, well, I thought about it like this. If I was the young me and somebody says, you're going to be the lead actor in a movie and you're going to direct the movie.
Yeah.
Would you even be thinking about, and you're going to make money?
Yeah.
Oh,
I mean,
you wouldn't be thinking about anything, but just like, this is great. This is fun. Yeah. Let's have fun. And there were moments on set where I was having fun and enjoying it in the moment, but we can't control that. And the more I try to enjoy what I'm doing, the process.
Yeah.
It makes life so much easier.
It does, but it is a constant. You have to be intentional about it, you know. So now I'm trying to make decisions about what I do based on like, oh, I love this actor. This is a small movie, but I love this actor. Mm-hmm. I want to learn from them. I want to watch how this guy works. So I'm going to do this movie. Movie may be great. It may not be great. It may be a hit. It may not be a hit. But I know that experience of working with this guy is going to be phenomenal. Like I did this movie Stuber years and years ago.
Yeah.
Didn't do well, but I met Dave Bautista and we're still like really, really good friends. And it was worth doing that movie from just like that connection I made. You know?
Boy, he's blown up, huh? Yeah. I love it too. I text him. I'm like, I'm so damn proud of you. Because I remember having conversations, even on the podcast. He's been on a couple times. And, you know, when I saw Guardians, he was on Smallville years ago.
I did not
and
know that.
And that's how we met. And one time I was at a convention and there was an announcement. Michael Rosenbaum, can you please go to the back somewhere? And I go, yeah, I'm about to leave on a plane. What's going on? They go, hey, Dave Bautista really wants to say hello to you. And I go, okay. And I went over and he's at a little private table or whatever in the back. He's doing like a private signing or something. I can't remember, but you go, Dave, are you sure you want to see me?
Yeah.
Because I didn't really remember. He goes,
you didn't remember?
Yeah, man, I heard you were here and you were always just so nice on set. And I just remember you're such a really good guy. And I just wanted to say hi.
Oh, man.
And I just go, I love you.
Yeah.
I love you. Wow. And then I saw him, I think it was before that, when I saw him in Guardians, and it was really Guardians 2, his performance, I said, this guy's special.
Yeah.
He's not just some wrestler who became an actor. He is working on it. Then I saw him in Knock at the Cabin. Best part of the movie was him.
Yeah.
Like he is consistently working and he's, you know, he works hard. And I love it. I love seeing his success.
I mean, I saw, you know, what I sort of learned. I'm always like, if I get to work with amazing people, what's my like takeaway? And there can be many. And with him, it was like, oh, working hard is cool. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like as a stand-up, you know, that's how I started. The whole thing of stand-up, at least the way we talked about it, was like working hard isn't cool. You have to like, it has to be effortless. It has to be whatever. I don't care. That sort of attitude was pretty big then when I was starting out. And that sort of seeped into it, even though I think in my bones, I'm a very hard worker, but I didn't want to present as that. But with Dave and the way he talks about acting in interviews, I was like, no, I'm a hard worker and I like talking about my work and I like talking about how hard I work. Like I really fucking love doing this and I want to give it my best shot. And so working with Dave, I really learned that he's so good in Blade Runner too, which I think is...
I didn't see that.
Oh my... Do you like the original one? People are mixed on it. Okay.
I'm not really a Blade Runner fan. I mean, it looks amazing, but I'm like, it's well, kind of boring.
See, I have a lot of patience for like
the original Dune you probably liked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the original Dune is a wild movie. There's like, you remember there's like a huge, I haven't read the books, but there's like a huge brain fish in it that's like fucking weird looking. And I was like, wow, why is that not in the new movie? And they're like, oh, David Lynch made that up. That
wasn't in the book.
That's not in the book. And it's like one of the best parts of the movie. It's this huge, crazy
Spina,
fish.
Joe, our friend Joe Spina, he loves Dune, the original. Yeah. He's like, you're an idiot. You don't know what you're talking about. That's it. I've read the book. The original is brilliant. Well, I like the new one.
Yeah, I think the new one's fantastic. But the Blade Runner, you know, I have a lot of room for like ponderous, heady sci-fi. So the original Blade Runner, I love it because no movie to me feels like that. There's like a couple emotional beats in it, like when Rutger Hauer's giving his like speech about as he's dying. Because the whole thing is like, are these replicants human or not? And then he gives this speech about all the things he's seen before he's dying. And you're like, oh, that answers that question. They can feel they're human. I'm getting emotional thinking about it. In high school, I could recite that whole speech because I thought that would get me laid, and it doesn't work. It does not work. But the new one, I think what it does,
all right,
is
I'll watch it.
It takes that world and it gives it a real like narrative drive. Like what you're saying, the first one you found boring. I get that. It's very much like a tone poem, but the new one has a mystery at the center. It really works. The story really works. It looks beautiful. Harrison Ford's great in it. Ryan Gosling's great in it. Batista's in one scene. He's great in it. I think it's a phenomenal movie.
When you talk about Eternals and it wasn't the response that you were hoping, how did that affect you? Did it really consume you for a while? Did it something you had to get counseling on? Is it something where you took it to heart? Like, was it me? Was it, what was this?
I knew it wasn't me. I think that there were a lot of things that went into it. I love that movie. I'm very proud of that movie. I'm proud of everyone's work in it, and I'm proud of my work in it. And I've seen that movie, you know, I've seen it a bunch of times because it's like my kind of movie. And I don't watch stuff I'm in a lot, and a lot of stuff I'm in I've never watched. It was really, really hard because Marvel thought that movie was going to be like really, really well reviewed. And so they lifted the embargo really early, and they also put it in some fancy movie festivals. And they sent us on a big like global tour promoting the movie right as the embargo was lifted. And so we had to like sort of travel the world while they thought we'd be going on a wave of raves, you know, and it wasn't true. It just sort of was, the reviews were really bad.
And you were aware of it while you were on tour?
Yeah, I was too aware of it. I was reading every review. I was checking too much because this thing had become too much in my head, because this was also after, right after the pandemic, you know, so we're coming out after this crazy thing, and I'm like, okay, this is gonna be the coming out party. I worked so hard for this.
And everything's heightened, your anxiety in life, everything's kind of like, and now this happens.
Everything's heightened. And I don't know. I mean, I think that there was some weird soup in the atmosphere for why that movie got slammed so much. And I think not very much of it has to do with the actual quality of the movie. Anyway, it was really, really hard. And that's when I was like, hey, this is unfair to me. It's unfair to Emily. I can't approach my work this way anymore. Some shit's got to change. And so very intentionally, I did start counseling. I still talk to my therapist about that. Emily says that, you know, obviously that I do have trauma from it. Emily and I just got dinner with someone else from that movie. And we were like, man, that was tough, wasn't it? He's like, yeah, that was really tough. I think we all went through something kind of similar. And then this guy that I'm talking about is like truly one of the best actors of our generation and has been nominated for an Oscar since then. So I realized I can't be so results-based in my work anymore, because I can't really control it. I can control my experience. I can control how I am to the people around me. I can control what I learn from it. I can control how I work. Can't control what people are going to think of it.
No. On a smaller level, you know, it was my first movie, really. And it was called Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. And it was with Clint Eastwood. And I had two scenes, but one was cut, but I had one big scene.
Is like that John Cusack?
Yeah. I had like a 7-minute scene in the courtroom. And I really loved my performance. And I really liked the movie. And the script was a bestseller, John Barron. I think that was the right.
Yeah, that was a big movie.
But it bombed. And I was like, how am I in one of the only Clint Eastwood movies to bomb? How am I, out of all his movies...
It sucks,
like, if this would have been a huge success, more people would, and it just, but a few casting people saw the movie and said, I like this kid, and it helped me out in ways. But, you know, I was like, oh, and then, you know, I did many movies that I thought were going to be, and then they buried us, or at the same weekend came other movies out. And then I look back and I go, I really love that movie, and I really enjoyed doing it, and the process was really fun. And that's what you gotta, like, you can't predict success.
No.
All you can do is strive for it.
All you can do
is enjoy it.
Yeah. You really have to enjoy it. We get to live our dreams. I mean,
we're living our dreams.
Yeah,
man.
We really are. And I know it's a tough industry and there's a lot of fucked up about it. And a lot of it is based on how well things are doing and how well things aren't doing. But you can't control that and just be happy for the opportunities you have. I mean, it's still a struggle. You know, I talk to my therapist about it a lot. I talk to Emily about it a lot. And
does she go, oh, come on, Camille?
I mean, she says I have career dysmorphia, which I think is probably a little bit true. So I still have like that thing of like the underdog, like, I'll show them what I got.
Yeah, you know? We all have that. Now, that's healthy.
I think it is healthy.
I think that's a good thing.
Well, part of the thing for me that I have to a little bit, what the chip on my shoulder about that specific thing is, I'm a brown guy who's a comedy guy. And so it's very easy to get put into a certain kind of box. And then when you change the box, suddenly you're in a different box and you're like, no, the point is I want to do shit I want to really challenge myself and learn and do shit I've never done before. And it's hard because in this business, for the most part, you are looking for other people to like see that in you, to give you that shot.
Validate you and kind of give you,
Give you that shot, you know? And so to me, that's that. I just want to be like, all right, what can I do now that's like totally different from anything I've done before? Or what can I do that combines a bunch of things that I've been learning the last few years in a new way?
Yeah.
So I'm always, that's sort of how I try and make my decisions.
Well, I think some people are, you know, they do a part and, you know, they're good at that part and they continue to do stuff like that and they don't have a big range and they get stuck sort of, you know, but with you, I think after you've obviously proven yourself dramatically and comedically.
Really?
I'm not an English guy.
Sometimes comically.
Sometimes comically. You've really done a good job. Yeah. But I was thinking about this when you're, you know, striving to be a comedian and going up every night and putting yourself out there. Did you ever seriously think in the back of your head, whether it's ego or drive or aspirations or perspirations, like that you wanted to become a serious actor, that you were going to be a serious actor?
Not at all. I didn't want to be an actor at all. I kind of fell into it. I think what helped me when I was doing stand-up was I never had a big plan in mind. It was always just like the next step is what I was looking for. So when I was doing open mics, I was like, I want to be booked on a show. And when I was booked on a show, I was like, oh, I want to be booked on the road outside of Chicago. And when I did that, I was like, oh, I don't want to host. I want to feature now. I want to go from doing 10 minutes to 20 minutes.
See, well, that's healthy. Look at that. Back then, you were going from step to step. You weren't jumping steps.
Exactly.
I want to be huge. Yeah. I want to have my own Netflix show.
And there were certainly people who thought like that. And oh, then yeah. Who did get that, you know? But I never had a grand vision. I just loved doing stand-up and I wanted to write funny jokes and wanted to do well, and each time try and like take a little bit step forward. And it sort of hurt me a little bit because I was in Chicago for 6 years, which is too long. It's fine now, but I should have stayed there 2 or 3 years. But because I sort of got stuck in a rut a little bit, and part of it was because I didn't have any kind of like grand aspiration. So I sort of fell into it. I fell into acting. But when I look back, you know, my favorite like Robin Williams is one of my favorites, right? And who's funnier than him? And I can't think of a stand-up comedian who's pivoted to serious acting successfully as he has while still doing comedy. Like he was kind of going back and forth. But his like serious performances are so good and so varied, you know? So as in
my uncle always says, Robin Williams puts on a beard when he's serious.
Yeah, he puts on that Good Will Hunting beard.
Put the Good Will Hunting beard on. Yeah. You're serious, but go ahead.
There's a monologue he has in it where he's talking to Matt Damon.
You see, go ahead.
You can do impressions.
I don't
right.
Robin Williams, but I'd like to. I could hear, I could see, you know, I could see his mannerisms. I bet if I worked it, I could do it.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
Some monologue. People have the ear for it. And
I could do a lot of impressions, but not. I've never tried Robin Williams.
Oh, that thing. He gives this monologue about, you know, it's a very famous one when he's in the park and he's talking to Will Hunting and he's sort of like, you know all these things, like you've read Shakespeare, but you've never been in a war. You've never seen your buddy like die in your arms. You could like quote sonnets about love, but you've never watched your loved one die of cancer. I'm getting emotional talking about it.
Oh, wow.
Is this really like, it's like a 7-minute monologue. And the first 5 minutes are just on Robin Williams' face.
See how that affects you? I could see the tears in your eyes.
Yeah.
That really still lingers with you. That performance, you just channeled it.
It's so open-hearted, that performance.
I love it.
And it's hardly a performance because it just feels like he's just telling the truth.
Oh.
And it's so magical. And it's so interesting because he can do that, which is very natural and very like open-hearted. And then he can also do Genie in Aladdin, which is very much a performance.
Yeah.
He's
brilliant. He really is brilliant. I think one that you can compare it to, but a lot of people will say I'm kind of weird, is Jim Carrey.
Yeah, Jim Carrey.
At times, there's been moments in Jim Carrey's career that I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
That was pretty impressive.
Well, Jim Carrey, I think when he was in his like comedy zone, I don't think there was ever been any comedic actor who's beaten that. When he was like, you know, Ace Ventura, Dumb and Dumber. The Mask. I saw The Mask again recently.
Holds up.
Yeah. And you forget that it's mostly just him in a green, like in green makeup. It feels CG, but you're watching, you're like, oh no, he's just doing that. He's moving his body like that.
He's unbelievable.
Obviously the special effects.
The best physical comedian there ever was. I mean, you think of who's the, you know, Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin. But
so
like,
different, right? They're so understated.
Yes. Oh, they're brilliant.
They're about the tension between their body and their face. Whereas Jim Carrey's really the whole thing. And
physicality.
And then Eternal Sunshine is such a magical one of those perfect.
How about what's the other one where he plays Truman Andy Kaufman?
Show? Oh, Man on the Moon. I've never seen that.
Oh, I love Man on the Moon. Did you see that? No, you don't have a mic. Sorry. but you were going back to, you know, the comedian and being a comedian and taking everything step by step and like being this. So you never had that in your mind to be a serious actor. When did you realize, and there was a moment where you realized, I'm good. I'm really good.
Well,
something's happening.
I'm good. I don't know. I really feel like I'm learning. I really am learning. And I can feel, I know the things that I don't know. That's a hard question to answer.
Do you know you're good at least? Do you go, you know, I know I'm good without being ego, like people tell you, but you go, I must be doing something right, obviously.
I do know, and I know when I'm good, and I know when I'm not quite as good. And even if other people can't tell, I can tell. And I know I can do more that I haven't shown yet and that I haven't learned yet. Like, I will sometimes, I'll watch a movie and I'll watch, like, a really, really great performance, you know? And I'll be like, I want to be able to do that. Mm. I think I could. I'd have to work and really, you know, but I'm like, I want to try and do that.
I've done that where I look at someone and I go, there's three ways, maybe two. I'm just spitballing here. But the first thing is I see some performance and I go, I could never do that.
I totally
that is absolutely beyond the realm of my capabilities.
A lot of like Jim Carrey, Robin Williams, those like comedic performances.
Well, just certain performances that like, yeah, exactly. And then there's sometimes where I go, I could do that.
Yeah.
I could really do that.
Yeah.
Like, I'll be honest with you. It's not that I would be better. It's not that I would, you know, for instance, Breaking Bad.
But okay to say that you would be better.
No, but Breaking Bad, Bryan Cranston, I watch and I go, he's fucking phenomenal. Could I do better? No. Could I play a part like that? Fuck yeah.
How awesome is that?
I would fucking love to play that.
Yeah.
The juxtaposition of good and bad and like,
yeah,
and just kind of comical at times and stuff. I would fucking, I know I could do that. I know from the work I put in and my life, I could do it. And well,
what a great feeling.
But I'm not saying I'm better than him or anything. I'm just saying I could play a part like that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's how you feel, right?
Yeah, sometimes, you know, the hardest one, and this is me being petty, is when you watch a big thing and someone in a big thing and you're like, I could be better than that.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm not talking actors at the level of Bryan Cranston, you know?
No, but
I'm
I do that, but I go like this. I go, I could do so much better than this dude. And then I go, but he's so much better looking than me.
I mean, that's usually...
That's what I usually say.
That's part of it,
he's
isn't it?
He's just so much hotter.
There's also actors who I find... Like, I certainly have my opinion on actors and acting. And there are certain actors where I'm like... everyone loves them. And I'm like, I could see all the choices you're making. I could like... With that, I can see your script right now and what notes you've written on the side.
You circle that.
Yeah. And I could see every like pivot you're doing. To me, the real magic, which I aspire to, is the I don't know how that happened. And I think there was like maybe one take where you did that. Or someone like Jack Nicholson, who could do take after take from what you read that is just as good. And when you watch it, there's no seams. There's no like decisions or choices. It's him just living, expressing.
I think that comes back to what you said before, to be able to be really relaxed and confident in what you're doing, knowing that you can do it, and just being, because there are actors who I call mirror actors, who look in the mirror the night before and do the scene to the mirror. And this is the one way and the only way they're going to do it. Not taking account in account the other people, because acting is listening. So when you're talking to an actor, your response could be different every time, depending on how they respond to you, like I'm responding
and
to you.
And that's all of it. That's all, that to me is all of acting.
And you have to be prepared to be malleable.
Yeah.
You must be present, like I'm trying to do in life.
But I've worked with actors. I've worked with both kinds of actors. I've worked with actors who are in a bubble where you start working with them and you're like, oh, you've decided you've got some target you're trying to hit. And each take, you're trying to hit that target. And I see what decisions you're making between takes. And I'm also seeing what notes you're getting and how you're taking those notes, you know? Those actors, sometimes when you watch them, you know, most people can't tell. There's big actors who work like that. Big, very successful actors. But when you're working with them, it's not that exciting. What is really exciting is when you're like, I don't know what you're going to do, but it's going to change what I'm going to do, and that's going to change what you're going to do, and every take's going to be different. When we did The Big Sick, worked with Holly Hunter, right, who's like one of the greats.
One of the greats.
Every take, all 28 days of our shoot, or 26 days of our shoot, no, it was like a five-week shoot, every take was completely different. There's a big scene in it where her and Ray Romano, who plays her husband, have this big argument in the hospital. And it's like, it's, everyone's got to be there, you know?
I remember, yeah.
They're like, they can't like really yell at each other.
It's in the waiting room, right?
It's in the waiting room.
Yeah, yeah.
It was, one thing was interesting was they, so her and Ray rehearsed that on set, and they'd rehearsed already on their own 14 times because they're blocking it as they're going. And I'm also a producer on the movie. So I'm like, fucking, we're going to go to lunch. What are we going to do? So 14 takes we do. 14 rehearsals, literally. And then Holly's like, all right, let's shoot. Because the whole time we're like, let's fucking shoot. You guys are so good. Let's shoot. Okay, let's shoot. And the AD goes rolling. And she lays down on the floor of this hospital. That's a real hospital. And closes her eyes. And everyone's just like silently like looking at this. It's completely quiet. And she's just laying in the middle
They're
of the
like,
floor.
Holy shit. What is she doing?
What is going on? And I guess the AD's like, cut, I guess. And for like 5 minutes, she lays there completely still. And then she wakes up and she's like, all right, let's shoot. And then they do three takes. Each take is completely different. And she crushes it and Ray crushes it. And it's great. And three, we make our day, you know. And then that was like one of the first days of shooting. So then a week later, now I've gotten to know her. We're shooting the scene in the middle of the night where we have to eat. And I was like, I got to ask you, when you laid down in the middle of the floor, what were you doing? And she said, I was just relaxing. She was just forgetting everything.
You know what? I think that's so important. I don't think we tell ourselves or allow ourselves to relax before things. We're all tense, cameras rolling, makeup there. All right, makeup out.
You got to find that space. Yeah.
You got to take your moment.
Yeah.
You take it. Actors ready. Give me a minute, please.
Yeah.
Take your moment. Get in the zone.
Yeah.
Breathe. Do whatever it takes. I remember Quentin Tarantino, I watched this interview, and I don't think anybody else has ever seen this interview, but it was like it was on TV. And he goes, the interviewer says, what do you, like, with actors, what kind of advice would you give actors or something? And he goes, oh, excuse me, could you zoom in? Can you zoom in my face? And the camera guy zooms in on him. He goes, listen, you guys don't know how much power you have. In an audition, it's your time. You guys, it's yours. You're bringing whatever it is. And he goes off on this thing. It's like, this is, and he filled me with confidence.
Yeah.
Like, this is you. This is your power. This is your time to shine. You do what you want.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he goes on about that. And I was just like, holy shit. Like, when you can actually relax and you're more capable, I think, of doing the things you want to do.
You really are. And I had this two things. One little quick thing when I was doing Chippendales, you know. I was working with Anna Lee Ashford, who's like one of the best actors I've ever worked with. And every take is different and exciting.
I love that.
There was a part where we have this big fight with each other. And after a few takes, I was kind of just feeling a little bit stuck and I didn't know what to do. And she's so good and I was feeling a little bit stuck. And I was like, all right, I'm just going to, in between takes, I'm just going to touch this table and I'm just going to really feel what this table feels like. Mm-hmm. I touched the table and I almost started crying because I had like sort of gotten locked down or stuck or whatever and in my head. And you just really like that got me present immediately.
Yeah.
The other thing I've noticed, you know, I started doing stand up again during these strikes. So I've been doing it about a month and a half now. And it's interesting because I've learned, because I had never learned to relax during stand up. It was always like really tight and go. And I was found myself defaulting into that mode when I started doing stand-up again, because it's the same like body memory, you know, you're like walk out the feeling of the mic, looking at all the people with anticipation, the clap, the clapping going down. You're like feel a little bit of sweat on your temple. What does that mean?
I'm going to pass out.
All that stuff.
Yeah.
And I've this last week and a half, you know, I do the alt shows, I do Largo, and those crowds know me, and I can sort of be very loose and it's fun. But I've also been doing the club. So I've been done the Hollywood Improv, and I've done the Comedy Store a whole bunch. And those places, they really want you to do tight jokes, and they really are, you know, it's a lot of tourists and stuff. So you really got to go and hit them. Yeah. And so I said, all right, when I do these clubs, I would get so fucking nervous. And I was like, I'm just not going to be nervous. And I'm going to meditate right before I go on stage. So it's the opposite. Instead of going out being like, I got to grab him by the throat and kill, it's the opposite. I'm not going to kill. I'm just going to go on stage and be completely relaxed and see what happens.
You're like a python.
Yeah.
Just slowly. Slowly kill him.
And it's the reaction has been so much better. For the first time at like the Comedy Store, I've been having great sets because I go out and I'm like, all right, let's see how this goes, and really lean back. And it's been a great lesson in exactly what you're saying, which is like relaxing. Look at what that says there.
Just relax.
Look at that.
Yeah. Look, perfect. That's your vantage point.
Yeah.
Perfect vantage point.
Remember that.
What makes you happy?
What makes me happy? That's a big answer. But really, the thing I love doing most is spending time with Emily. Me and her.
Oh, come on. You made me cry now.
Genuinely, like at home, watching movies, playing video games. Or what I really love is me and her going to a restaurant, like, and just eating and just having just the two of us for hours. That's my favorite thing to do.
I honestly, I'm not just saying this. I love her.
She's the greatest.
I love her. I really got to hang out with her the first time at James's wedding, James Gunn's wedding.
Oh, she's
name drop, but
yeah.
And then just hanging out with her here, she's just so funny.
She's
so genuine. It's like unbelievable. She just it's amazing how like it's 16 years and you guys been together. It's not amazing because I see you together and it's just like what I see is that you both just let each other have their moment and just do their thing and just let them be who they are.
She's one of those magic people, like truly. And I say that to her and she's like, oh, you just love me. I'm like, I do love you, but everyone else sees it too.
Yeah,
other people see. She has that thing where people immediately connect with her. And she's so fucking funny. She'll just say things that I'm like, or she'll say something really profound. And I'm like, poetic. And I'm like, where is that from? She's like, well, I just said it. I'm like, write that down. So she has a document of just stuff she just randomly says to me that I'm like, write that down. Because she was a therapist, you know? So she has this, like, she understands people and loves people so much. And it's also just really funny and really insightful. And she's one of those people.
I got a book idea for you.
Yes.
It's called Emily Writes Stuff Down. And it's a book of all the things she's written down over the years. Profound, poignant, funny, ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know.
I'm trying to think what she said just yesterday that I was like, that's like two words, but I think there's no better combination of two words in this context than right now. I'd have to like look through my text. But she's just so, I'll be like, what is that, who quoted that? I'm like, I just said it. Is that anything? I'm like, yeah, that's like the coolest thing I've heard in weeks.
You know, it sounds like we talk about listening is the most important thing, obviously, in acting.
Yeah.
But I'm not married. I'm single. I'm figuring it out. Just that's all I'll say. But would you say that that's the number one thing in a marriage? To keep it healthy?
It's the hardest. It's going to sound the most pat and the most like, but the most like cliche, communication. There is nothing listening and telling each other what's really going on inside. That's the most important thing, genuinely. Because for a long time, I would keep stuff from her. Like, I mean, like, I have a job coming up. I'm scared. I'm nervous. What if I can't do this? What if I'm not good enough? I just keep that inside. Because if I say it, it becomes real. I found if I just say it to her, like, hey, just so you know, I'm scared about this thing coming up. I don't know if I can do it. It actually takes its power away. And so really telling each other what's going on inside, by far the biggest breakthrough we've had in our marriage is that, and it sounds so, like it sounds cliche, like I said, but you really have to be intentional about it. There was a time where we were like, every day, both of us have to say three things to each other. This was when we went to couples therapy. Three things to each other that are vulnerable, genuinely vulnerable. And so we did that exercise for a few weeks, and it was fucking great.
Vulnerable.
Yeah.
I of course, think of me saying that to someone.
Yeah.
I immediately thought of, like, what would I say every day? Three new things.
They can be big things or small things.
Sorry about premature ejaculation.
Yeah, sure.
That's that embarrassing. Would count. That's vulnerable.
It is.
Sorry for always crying during movies.
Do you cry during movies?
No, but you do.
I do. I've started to.
No, I do cry. I do cry. I get emotional. I get emotional when it reflects something that's happened in my life, or it's parallel to things that I have witnessed as a child or as an adult, and I can relate, or victims or whatever, or people in general. When it's real, it can be pretty visceral.
Yeah, I mean, that's the magic of what we get to do, right? Like, when it's good, you really have, you're like, people can see themselves. You know, Emily says that she does what she does because she wants to make people feel less lonely, because loneliness comes from not sharing yourself, you know?
And wow.
And you see people going through the same things you go through.
Look at this.
And you realize, oh, we have a visitor.
I'll finish that. That was an important thought. Oh, that is,
what a beautiful...
Hold on, go say hello. Come out.
Hi. How beautiful.
Come here.
How beautiful are you? Hi, baby.
She's hi. Just, he. All right, get out, guys. Get out. Come on. In the middle of an interview.
Are they like best buds? Hi.
The Blanche is my beauty. She's five. Look at this guy.
Oh, my God.
You know what? This is a great way to end the interview, isn't it? I mean, there's no better way.
I mean, you have to. You can plan and stuff, and then suddenly.
You can't plan this.
Beautiful dogs.
Kamel, you're a beautiful man. This has been a real treat. Will you come back again sometime?
Oh, of course.
This is so easy. It's so easy.
Of course.
You're so open. Yeah. I love you.
I love you, buddy.
All right. Bye. What else can you say about the guy?
I mean,
funny, smart. Talented.
He's the real
handsome.
Deal. He's all the things. He's the real deal. That was a cool one. He's one of those guys that I've been watching for a long time. It was cool to see him in the flesh, and cool that he's, you know, a good soul.
A good egg.
A good egg.
He's really a good egg. I've had some good conversations with him, and he's just got a big heart and a dark sense of humor too, which I love.
Yeah.
I like that you can just talk, you know, how his mind works. It's, you know, you could say something so really funny and dark, and then say something so beautiful at the same time. And Emily is a genius.
Oh, yeah.
His wife. I freaking love her. She's she and I have some good laughs. Thank you for listening to that. And make sure you follow us on our handles and all that at Inside of You Podcast on Instagram and Facebook, at Inside of You Pod on the Twitter. And support the podcast. Go to patreon.com/InsideOfYou and join today, and you can give back. You guys keep the show alive. So whether it's $1 a month or $5 and whatever it is, but the top tiers here give a lot and they get their names wrote out and other stuff. So we're going to jump into that now. We're going to do the top tier podcast shout outs, top tier patrons. I love these guys and I love all my patrons. So let's just do that. Patreon.com/InsideOfYou. Let's go. Why don't you lead us off with old Nancy D?
Nancy D, Leah and Kristen, Little Lisa, Yukiko, Jill E, Brian H, Nico P, Robert B, Jason W, Sophie M, Raj C, Jennifer N, Stacey L, Jamal F, Jen LB.
Yes, we're doing a YouTube Live, so make sure you guys get on that. And my YouTube Live is next week, and then I'm gonna schedule a Zoom with the top tier patrons. So you guys be aware of that. And also, if you send messages, I know on Google, I don't check them often. But I appreciate them. Sometimes they're so long, I can't really respond. But I do look at them and I do appreciate it. If I don't respond, you know, I still do look at them. So it's just hard to respond to everybody. I get so many messages and I appreciate you. Mikey Eldon Supremo, 99 more. Hello, Dan. Hello, 99 more. Santiago M. I can't wait till Glover gets his statue. Leanne P. Maddie S. Belinda N. Dave H. Sheila G. Brad D. Ray H. Tabitha T. Tom N. Talia M. Betsy D. Rhiannon C. Corey K. Dev Nexon.
Michelle A. Jeremy C. Brandy D. Eugene and Leah. Corey Mel S. Christine S. Eric H. Shane R. Andrew M. Oracle. Amanda R. Kevin E. Stephanie K. Jor L. Jammin' J, Leanne J, and Luna R.
Mike F, Stonehenge, Brian L, Jules M, Kendall L, Jessica B.
Kyle
no, L. No, that was still me.
No, you were, all right, whatever.
I know, I was slow. Kyle, I was thinking of an impression. Kyle F, Kaylee J, Brian A, Marion Louise L, Romeo the Band, Frank B, Jen T, Nikki L, April R, M, Randy S, JDW, RLP, Rachel D.
Lorelai L, Melissa H.
Lorelai.
Nick W, Stephanie and Evan, Charlene A, Don G, Jenny B, John. It's just John.
Just John.
Just John.
It's not just John. It's John.
It's not John.
It's John. Hey, everybody. It's John.
John. Well, John.
Jennifer R, Tina E, MG Tracy, Junie. Junie's relatively new. And Tasha S. That's some newbies. I love that people are like, you know, sometimes I look and I'm like, oh my gosh, I have another top tier or another patron. And I try to send messages and stuff. So it's cool. Patreon.com/insideofyou. Thank you for listening. As always, we'll try to bring you the best guests we can and give you the best conversations, and hopefully it will help and hopefully you'll enjoy it. And thank you from the Hollywood Hills in Hollywood, California. I am Michael Rosenbaum.
I'm Ryan Taylor. We're doing this voice again.
Yes, we are. We'll wave to the camera. Thank you guys. Always. I love you. And just be good to yourself. I'll see you.
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone's senior writer, Brian Hyatt.
Now, here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band, and they must think this kid must have just been handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.